First of all, my name's Jerry, and it is not general or doctor or anything else. I'm past that. My grandkids don't care who I am. They just call me Papa. And it's wonderful about kids. They don't care what you did, what you've done, what you are, where you've been. All they want is for you to be there. And, you know, the fact is, as adults, that's what we want to. We tend to put people on some kind of little pedestal, or we tend to give them honor, and that's good in many ways, because in our jobs and our work in our country, it's an important thing. But the fact is, we all come down to the end of things, and we're just who we are before God. There's a verse in Deuteronomy that is one of my favorite verses, and it says, "Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands." It's interesting. It says, remember all the way that the Lord your God led you. That's the good and the bad and the indifferent and the great and the not so great and the problems and all of that. But I think the point is to remember. When Moses wrote that, the people had just come out of the wilderness. They had seen all of their parents die. Everybody who was over the age of 20 had died. And so I think it's very important for us to think back and to actually remember what God has done. And so, even though there are notes for three messages in there, I'm going to give four messages here, and we're going to go kind of part and part on those. But Mary and I really felt that it was more important to begin our time tonight to just share a little of our own personal testimony. So Mary, why don't you come up here with me for just a minute? And we'd like to just review a little part of our life. So about half of what we share tonight is going to be our testimony, and then I'll get started on some of the material. We're not a big group, so I don't care how fast we go. I don't care whether we finish anything. If we want to interrupt and do questions, if we want whatever it is you want to do, we're here for you and to be with you. So as Greg mentioned, that I'm from a very, very small town. I actually wasn't from a farm, but it was a farm community in Iowa. 100 people, and it still got 100 people. All my cousins most of my cousins still live there. Everybody in town and around town is now related to one another. And I think, you know, how recessive genes start taking place after a while, and I think that's probably happening around my little community. We were back there a year ago for the 4th of July. Mary just loved it. She comes from a big town. How big was yours?
500.
500 people where?
In Minnesota.
Yeah, so a little in western Minnesota. And so we both come from a pretty, I guess, humble beginnings. And we'll tell you just a little bit about that. But last summer when we were back in Garden City, Iowa, for the centennial celebration, 100 years old the town was, the house I was born in, and I was born in the house, not in a hospital, was the first house that was built in the town, right next to the railroad tracks. We had a parade. They had 80 entries in the parade. I've never seen more combines and tractors and trailers and whatever. And so those of us who went to this little one-room schoolhouse, we got on a float. And three of the teachers were there, one of whom had me when I was a child. And we went around, and the whole thing stopped. So all of us on the float got off, and we just realized the front end had met the back end of the parade, and the parade was actually supposed to keep going, but we got off and left. It was pretty informal place. Small little Norwegian community. Everybody was Lutheran, but of course nobody knew what Lutheran was because it was just the church that was there in town, and all the older people in the town spoke Norwegian. My mother married, and when she was very, very young, I was born when she was about 17 years old, and within a few months, something terrible happened in the sense of a little community like that. My parents got divorced. And you can imagine that was the talk of the town. And just as unheard of thing at that point in time. And so I was raised basically by my mother and my grandfather. And some say, oh, you poor kid. Poor kid. I had the run of the town. I got cookies at every house. Everybody felt sorry for me. I had a wonderful time. It was just an absolutely marvelous time in growing up. Mary, why don't you just tell a little of your background right now?
Thanks. My family was large. My father came from a family of 14, and my mother from a family of 5, and most of them lived around this little town. And most of them were believers. And in this, it was a very close environment. I knew of Jesus from the time I can remember. And so I did make a commitment to the Lord. I understood that Jesus died for my sins and that by receiving him, I could have eternal life. And I did that when I was a child. Then when I was 19 years old, my parents moved, and I transferred schools to the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington. For the first time in my life, I heard the name of Jesus ridiculed. And it came as such a shock to me. And it was, I really kind of floundered for the first several months that I was there. Finally got connected with a group there. Actually, Jerry was a part of it. It was in a church at that time, although we had begun to have some navigator contact. But I found out about this group, and they said, well, Jerry White drives to this church group, so you could call him and get a ride. And he came to pick me up. He was gracious enough to offer to give me a ride. And the first time I saw him, he was wearing a navy blazer and lime green checked slacks.
So, I thought they were pretty nice myself.
Yeah. In his favor, that was all the rage at the time. But I think that was my point of lordship. I chose to identify myself with God's people. And to make that my life commitment, those things I'd been taught from the time I was little became my own convictions.
I think personally a wonderful little childhood, and just really, I did not realize that I really didn't have a father there. I mean, I understood it, but it wasn't a big deal because I'd never known him. Then disaster struck as far as I was concerned. At the end of World War II, my mother remarried. And so I left this little town of Garden City, Iowa, with a father that I did not know, from a one-room schoolhouse and a town of 100 to a city of 180,000, almost 2,000 miles away, out in Spokane, Washington. And my third grade there was bigger than my entire school, and I was one really shook-up kid. It was incredibly traumatic, and I'm sure that to this day, I don't even know all the effect, but I became very inward, very afraid of everything, very anxious, very worrisome, and so life was not fun at all. It was an absolutely miserable time for me for the next several years. But while I was there, we were in a little post-World War II housing project. It probably looks like some of the buildings that are on this base. And our whole house wasn't a third even of this little room. It was just a tiny little place. And my dad was going to school, my stepfather. And somebody talked me into going to a small Sunday school in the community. In this little military housing project, they built a community center and a gym and so forth. And several businessmen from Spokane just decided to have an outreach to kids. Just like you move into a base and say, we're going to start having Bible studies or I'm going to teach Sunday school. And a man by the name of Bob Shepler became my Sunday school teacher, and he ran it like a Marine drill sergeant. He was a great guy. In fact, I saw him the last week of January, or the last, last week in January, and he died just a month and a half later. So he just died just a couple months ago. But Bob started sharing the gospel. Now, I know the folks back in my little Lutheran community, and I know that my teachers, very likely as I look back, knew the Lord, but it didn't communicate to me. I didn't really understand what the gospel was. We kind of went to church, we did that, and that was it. And everybody, when they became 12 years old or 13, went through confirmation, and that was it for the rest of life. And you know that, don't you, from your community. So nothing really registered with me. I had a teacher back there. No one in the town under the age of 70, there wasn't anyone who had not been in her Sunday school class. I mean, she died finally in her 90s, and she was just the kindergarten teacher. But Bob started sharing with us what it meant to have sin, and I knew I was a sinner, talking about Christ, about Jesus, that he died for our sins. And I was, as I said, very inward and did really not want to venture out into anything new. I listened to this for almost 2 years before I did anything about it. I was coming back from an outing to a lake one day, and a college student that Bob had working with us asked if any of us would like to pray and receive Christ into our hearts. And I'd been thinking about it, and I said, yeah, I would. And so I prayed and asked Christ to come into my life, and I knew exactly what I was doing. This is a commitment that was real. I went in directly and told my parents exactly what had happened. And I'm still in touch with that guy who was a college student, by the way. He lives in Palm Springs now. He's a prof at the University of California, Northridge, or Cal State Northridge, rather. And so I came to Christ, and then Bob started nurturing me along. I worked for him. When I went into high school, I got involved in Youth for Christ, deeply involved in our church. But outward, I was this young kid who had some leadership gifts that were starting to come out. But inward, I felt like a fraud. I felt like a hypocrite because I kind of like felt like I was playing the game. You know, I was being religious. I was being a good kid, but I didn't have any depth to me. So when I went off to the University of Washington, it wasn't my parents, none of whom had gone to college, but it was this Bob Shepler who drove me across the state to Seattle and introduced me to someone, and the guy actually told me where I should live. And the first guy I met was a guy who was involved with the Navigators. He became my roommate, and he started meeting with me every day. You talk about man-to-man. We had man-to-man every day. We had a quiet time together every day for those first 3 months. And I learned how to have a quiet time. And if you don't know how to do that, you go to Felix's workshop to learn how to have a quiet time. and started making some lordship commitments in my life. Mary and I met. And now that I think about it, it must have been to our parents' chagrin. We were married before our senior year in college. So we were married young, but we figured it was the economical thing to do. She should go to work for Boeing, and I should finish school. We were both working our way through. I said, oh, then you'll finish. Small chance. 10 years later.
12
years later. Yes, she remembers it. And so everybody at that point went in the military. I'd gone through ROTC and went on active duty in the Air Force. I was going to fly. And if you want to hear the story, I'll tell it at another point. But right at the end of pilot training, I washed out. And it was a blow to me. To that point, I'd never failed at anything. And so we just told the Air Force, send us somewhere, and they sent us to Cape Canaveral at Patrick Air Force Base in Florida. And we became very involved in a military life there. But life wasn't that simple, and I'll let Mary tell a little about that.
One reason Jerry wrote the book on living with some chaos in your life is that we became experts at a chaotic lifestyle, and especially then, and it was before we learned what it meant to focus. And we were involved in several things in the chapel, teaching Sunday school and music and extracurricular activities in the chapel and sports and hobbies and I can't even remember, civic things, all kinds of things. And we had no pattern, no regularity to our life. It was just chaotic. And I had grown up in a home where I never saw my parents have conflict. I think they must have. I mean, you can't live together without some, but they did not show it to us. So I thought that was the pattern. So I did not speak up and say, look, let's rethink the way we're living our lives here. And we had a little boy by then, and Jerry didn't see much of him, and Jerry and I didn't see much of one another. And finally, probably in not a very godly or biblical way, I began to point out these problems to Jerry.
What it was. It just exploded.
That's about right.
And I said, what's wrong?
Didn't see it. There wasn't anything wrong as far as I could tell. She saw something.
But that's when we began to feel the Lord leading us to narrow down, to focus our lives and our efforts, and to bring some kind of order that would be honoring to God into our lifestyle.
It was during this time at Cape Canaveral, my thought was I'll just spend my X years, I think it was only three back then, get out and go back to Seattle. I had a job waiting for me at Boeing Aircraft Company. And I had a very interesting experience one day. I was out on my front lawn talking to my neighbor. And I asked Fred's a little older than I was. He was an Annapolis grad. I said, Fred, what are you going to do in your next assignment? He said, well, I want to go to the Air Force Academy to teach. And I said, well, how do you do that? And we had this conversation. And I can't quite explain it to this day, but I've rarely had God, quote, speak to me. But it came quite clear to both Mary and me as we talked that God was directing us to stay in the Air Force, to go to the Air Force Academy to teach, for me to get some further growth with the navigators who were located there, and to reach out to students at the Air Force Academy. Now, where did that come from? I'd never even visited there. I had no clue. And so we began to pray. And I applied to the Air Force to go off for a master's degree because I found you had to have one in order to teach at the academy. They sent me back and said, well, you're qualified, but we don't send lieutenants to grad school. So it was out. So we said, now what do we do? So we started praying, said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll wait one more year. And I'll apply again. And if God doesn't open that door, we'll just get on with our lives and go do what we ought to do. And it was during that year when we had this crisis in our marriage. And when we realized that the way we were living was not good, that I was working far too hard, involved in far too many things, putting incredible pressures on Mary. And you name it, we were not doing things well. But then a year later, I applied again and heard nothing. Zero. And I thought, now what is God doing? And then I got a telegram through our personnel office, and it was a telegram that I was supposed to go to Andrews Air Force Base, which is our command headquarters, and just report in. And nobody knew why. My boss didn't know why. The personnel officer didn't know why. And so here I got on an airplane, went up to Andrews, went into the personnel office, and this guy said, here's the reason we asked you to come up here. We're having a conference of colonels and brigadier generals who are deputy chiefs of staff of personnel for the major commands in the Air Force. And the topic of the conference is how to get young officers to stay in the Air Force. They call it a career motivation congress. It said, these guys have not been junior officers for a long time, and we'd like a junior officer to tell them what junior officers want. And we'd like you to give a speech. I said, me? I said, do you understand that I'm not a career officer? I said, yeah, we know that. I said, can I say anything I want? I said, you can say anything you want. So I said, okay, you're on. And I said, by the way, I've got an application in to go to school, and I have no idea where it is. So we went hunting it down. It was, and if you're sergeants, you know this, it was in the bottom of a sergeant's desk drawer. And I said, well, that's an interesting place to have it. I said, what's it doing there? And he says, well, you haven't been in your assignment for 3 years, so the command is not going to release you. I said, okay. And I thought, well, that's the answer to prayer. And as we were walking out the door, I'd shared my testimony with this personnel officer, this captain, and he said, listen, let me introduce you to, let me do so. And I said, no, don't do anything. I said, the fact is that I left this with God, and I'd prefer for it to stay there. Well, I went back to Patrick, wrote my speech, came back a month later or 6 weeks later, gave the speech, and two things happened as I walked off the podium in this conference room. A colonel came up to me, introduced himself at the coffee break, said, "Lieutenant, if you'd ever like to teach at the Air Force Academy, let me know." Just out of the blue. I mean, he didn't know me from Adam. I had no conversation. He was a personnel guy at the Air Force Academy. So I took down his name dutifully and phone number. Then that night, at the closing banquet, another colonel caught me as I walked out of the officers' club. And he says, "Lieutenant White, I hope you have a good school tour." And they'd pulled my record and released me from my command and sent me off to school. Via Ethiopia, by the way. But I had a little detour en route. So Mary and I engaged on another phase of life and ended up staying in the military, which was not what we had intended to do at all. And the academy and so forth. And then God switched on us again. And someone said, "Would you consider leaving active duty and coming full-time with the NAVS?" Which blew my mind. I had not intended to do that. But we said, okay, like we've done at every point, we'll pray. And God led us out. And life was just going great. I entered the reserves, kept getting promoted, had just gotten promoted to Brigadier General. And then disaster struck in our lives again, and I'll let Mary talk about that.
Well, we have four children, a son and three daughters, and we have 11 grandchildren. But in 1990, Jerry and I were traveling. We were at a large conference in Columbus, Ohio, and received a phone call that told us that our son, our eldest child, had been murdered the night before on his job. And Steve was a radio announcer for the National Public Radio System, but he also owned and drove his own cab to make more money. And he picked up a fare in that cab, and the man had just intended to kill somebody, and he just killed Steve, didn't rob him or anything. And I remember when we heard the news, Jerry took the phone call and turned to me and told me the news, and I could only say, "Oh God, oh God," not in any profane sense, but simply that God was the only foundation left. And there's a verse in Proverbs 18:10 that says, "The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe." And there are times when only God is what's left in our lives. And if you haven't come to that point, at some time you probably will in your life. And just the idea, as we were flying home in the airplane, just thinking that from Isaiah 43, that when you want to hold
right there,
that when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. God is speaking. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, the flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God, your Savior, the Holy One of Israel. And so no matter what happens to us, and this is probably the worst thing that can happen to a parent, God is there, and He is faithful to His promises. That was what we discovered during the time our son died.
Okay. Well, this obviously made life chaotic again. We entered into you can go ahead. You can ask Mary questions now if you'd like to. I thought it would be good for us to share this together so that you get to know both of us, even though Mary is not doing the speaking at this time. But what we want to do is to give you a glimpse into our lives. Our lives have not been simple. Our lives have been extremely chaotic. Our lives have had some incredible disturbances in them through the years, and these are just a couple of them, obviously pretty big. But this cast us into a world that Mary and I had never known, a world of crime and police. And since I was fairly well known in Colorado Springs because of my job with the Navigators, it was a huge funeral with plainclothes policemen scattered throughout it because we did not know who had done it at that point in time. We tried to get the newspapers to not put our pictures in the paper because my daughters were very frightened because they didn't know whether it was a personal attack on our family or what it was. So it was a time of tremendous confusion. The television stations asked if they could come to the funeral. We said no. And some unusual things happened during that time, and I might share a little of them later on. But through these next years, by the way, the man was caught and is currently in prison, but it's been going through the courts now for almost 10 years, and we just finished about a year and a half ago in the Colorado Supreme Court, and just a week ago yesterday, or 2 weeks ago yesterday, I think, Mary, when was it? About 2 weeks ago, that Mary went to the sheriff's department and got Steve's things back because they'd been holding him for a further possible trial. So when things happen in your life, you realize nothing ever quite ends. It's like a marriage. It never ends, and it shouldn't. But even when there's a divorce, it doesn't end. I mean, life goes on with all its memories, all its wounds, and all its hurts. Some of you may come from a divorced family. I came from one, but it really was not a problem. That part of it wasn't. The remarriage was the problem. Some of you come from backgrounds that may not have been very easy for you growing up in. And all of those things have a memory and leave a mark on you and give you difficulty later on. And that, along with experiencing many things with many of our friends, many of our staff, and many of the people we're in touch with, led me to do some work on what it means to live in chaos. Because all of us are going to have chaos in our lives, of one kind or another. Sometimes it's major, sometimes it's minor. At the time, everything is major. But it's not easy. I remember the story of a 96-year-old man who was being admitted to a nursing home. And they had a psychological profile they wanted him to fill out. And one of the questions was, did you have a happy childhood? And he said, so far, so good. And I thought, way to go. That's what my stepfather always used to say, how's it going, Dad? So far, so good. But you know, for a lot of us, it's not so far, so good. And even at your relatively young age to mine, life has not perhaps been very simple. Things are going on in your extended family. Things are going on with your friends. Things are going on in your job, in your work environment that have made life very, very difficult for you. So my plan during this time is to try and walk you through some ideas on what creates chaos in our lives. How do we face it? And how do we make good out of the chaos that we face? And so that's kind of the outline for the time. And how do we then get purpose in our lives?